Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
What if the biggest threats to your faith isn't doubt? What if it's familiarity? What if the reason you feel disconnected, exhausted, or spiritually dry isn't because you've walked away from God, but because somewhere along the way, you stopped experiencing Him? Today's guest says one of the most dangerous things that can happen is when faith becomes something we know instead of someone we know. And his new book might be the wake-up call millions of people need right now. Welcome back to the show. Today is a very special episode because it is launch day for Dr. Carter Cech's brand new book, Plagiarizing the Gospel. Now, before we jump into this conversation, I want everyone listening to know that his book is available right now at plagiarizingthegospel.com. We'll also put the link in the show notes. And so Dr. Cech is a U.S. Army veteran, a board-certified clinical chaplain, a suicide prevention specialist, a healthcare ethicist, professor, best-selling author, and he helps veterans and first responders heal through the outdoors. But today's conversation isn't about credentials. It's about something so much more personal. It's about the quiet drift that can happen to any of us. The moment when we're still showing up, still doing all the things, still saying the right words, but something inside feels different. Today, we're talking about why Carter wrote this book, what it cost him to write it, who it's for, and why this message matters now more than ever. Dr. Carter, it's really great to see you again. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's an exciting day, and I look forward to the conversation and of course, sharing about the book, but just seeing where this goes.
Yeah. So today is launch day, and what does that moment feel like after everything it took to get here?
Yeah, it's quieter than expected. This might surprise some people, but this is the first book that I've actually written that is centered around my faith. And I say my faith, my Christian faith. And anybody who's seen me on any of the podcasts or even read Healing in the Wild knows that I'm one of those people that I don't encounter individuals some predetermined journey I think they need to go on, and nor do I expect people to believe like I believe.
Right.
Since January of 24, I've written almost 40 books, and this is the second book that I've published. And that journey of writing has been not just therapeutic, but it has been very cathartic for me. I didn't realize how important writing was for me in that way until I just decided to start doing it, you know, and stopped making excuses for being too busy to do it and just picked my moments. But this book is different, Lisa. This one was, you know, I had already written over 30 books, and I was really excited because I was like, hey, I'm going to introduce my first book. It was actually was from a trilogy that I wrote called Storm Walkers. That's about walking through storms, right? Because storms are always going to happen. And I was super excited because it was really the first book about my genuine faith and speaking about scripture and just how I've walked through storms in my life and walked through others as they've walked through storms. And I was in my office where I'm sitting right now. And you know, I'm not going to project how people hear God or how your relationship is with God, but I know how mine is, and I know how the Lord speaks to me in moments. And I just remember sitting there, and I had this impression of, don't release Stormwalkers, you need to write one more. And the way that this has happened with me for, you know, 30 plus times is I would hear a title, I would see a cover, and then I would get this understanding of a chapter map of like, what does this book look like a table of contents almost. And it was really like a really awesome and cool experience for me because that hadn't necessarily happened. Like, but after that's happened over 20 times, I hear a title and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to see a cover, I'm going to get a chapter map. And I heard Plagiarizing the Gospel. And as a professor, that didn't sit well with me because plagiarism is, it's not a really good word. Around
it's got a bit of a negative connotation,
right?
To it, for sure.
Yeah. So I kind of sat back in my desk and I was just like, okay, well, I heard a title. So I'm thinking I'm going to get a cover in like this chapter map. And what I got was silence. And immediately, shame tried to come in the room and say, see, you did something wrong. See, you've been plagiarizing the gospel. You know, this is, and you know, I deal enough with shame that I recognize, no, this isn't, that's not what this is. This is something different. So I just sat back in my chair and I just said, Lord, help me understand what you're trying to tell me. Have I been plagiarizing the gospel? And I heard, and it wasn't an audible voice. Okay. And maybe God speaks to you in an audible voice. And if he does, that's awesome. But, you know, I don't normally get that. I usually I've spent enough time in what I call the secret place that I know what my voice sounds like and what the Lord's voice sounds like. And I heard, no, but you used to. And I said, okay, well, help me understand that, God, because I'm not getting a cover. I'm not getting a chapter map like I normally would get. So I don't understand. And all I heard was just, and so I started writing. And as I wrote, what came out was this book. And so when I say, you know, launch day is kind of quieter than I expected, is because what came out through the discovery of this book was so loud, right? I have been living with this material for a very long time. And the writing years, you know, the writing started years before this manuscript did. And these were seasons I'd lived through before I had language for them. And then years of trying to find the right language before I had the courage to even write it down. And so I think what I feel most today is kind of a release. This book is no longer mine to carry alone. It belongs to whoever needs it now. And that is a great place to be.
Absolutely. That's a great story. I also hear whatever you want to, like, whatever people want to call it, whether it be God or spirit, mm-hmm. in my own voice. But I also have a knowing that it's not me. And so it's interesting. I would want to meet someone who hears different voices. That would be phenomenal. cool.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people ask me, how do you hear God? Right. You know, how do you hear God? Yeah. And I usually tell them this story. And I don't know if this will resonate with everybody, because not everybody who's listening is a parent. But there is a time as a parent when your children can't audibly call for help. They're young. They can cry. And there's distinctive types of crying. OK. And there's a cry that you'll hear that is like, Dad, I need you right now. And then there's a cry that's like, I'm just crying. And here's what I'm trying to say. When you hear that, Dad, I need you right now cry, there is a visceral reaction to that, Lisa. There is something within you. You could call it your conscience bearing witness. It's something that you're locked into, because you know, it's like, I need to be there right now. It's like if you saw your kid playing in the middle of the road and you saw a car speeding down the road. It's that type of reaction, okay? And most people that I talk to that have a child, then I would say this. I would say, is it safe to say that if I blindfolded you and took you into an auditorium full of crying kids at the same age of yours, that you could walk me directly to your kid? And every single one of them says, yes, absolutely. Because that voice, that noise, that what comes out of their child is so connected to them that it's you can't mistake it. And I could blindfold you and you could walk right to. What it's like.
That's what it's like
when you spend time in the secret place. And when I say the secret place, this is what I mean. The secret place is where you make it. It's away from this thing. OK, it's away from the noise. It's in the quiet where you have to wrestle with your thoughts. You have to wrestle with all the calendars and the lists and all the distractions that try and take over your thought life when there's no noise. Most people use noise to drown out the thoughts and the calendars. But when it's quiet, you're forced to wrestle with all of that. And mm-hmm. When you are forced to wrestle with it, then you're forced to wrestle with the fact of, okay, God, are you speaking to me? Because most people go into a relationship with God and they always say or want something. They rarely sit back and listen to what God has to say like a natural conversation, because they're always battling with their to-do list, their calendar, their, oh my gosh, you know, you get in there and you're trying to spend time with God and all of a sudden you start thinking about your grocery list or that email that you didn't send, or did I make that payment to Amazon? Did I order that last book? Right. And What ends up happening is when you spend enough time consistently, just like fitness, just like working out, just like anything you would do consistently to build something, when you spend enough time doing that and you really learn to hear God speak to you, then it's unmistakable. It's like that child. It's like that child crying when you're blindfolded. To me, it's like being in the quietest corridor and hearing the loudest trumpet you've ever heard. When you hear that, it's okay. So that's what I heard when I said, when I say I heard plagiarizing the gospel, it was like that. So it was no mistake who was talking, right?
Right.
It was so loud to me. Yeah, it was so loud to me. And, you know, this book is about the gap between knowing the gospel and living it. Not the gap created by rebellion or disbelief, but that quiet gap that opens when familiarity replaces intimacy, that mm-hmm. secret place intimacy. So when you've been in faith long enough that the words come automatically, the practice continues without effort. And somewhere along the way, you've stopped encountering the God behind them. And plagiarism is taking someone else's words and presenting them as your own. So spiritually, it's what happens when you carry language that was once alive in you, but's no longer coming from a living encounter. The words are still true. They're just no longer yours in the way that they once were.
What was the hardest truth to put on the page in terms of this book? And I also want you to describe this book in one or two sentences that really would illustrate to the audience who this book is for and the story behind the book.
Yeah. This book is a confession. It's not a theory. Okay. The seasons that I write about are seasons I lived. And there were times that I spoke accurately without being nourished by what I was saying. You know, in my day job, a lot of times I'm speaking with people who are in the worst, some of the worst moments of their life as a suicide prevention specialist. Now, some of them have theistic faith where they're connected to relationship with God. And those conversations are a little different with a clinical chaplain where I can lean into like faith. And some of those conversations are have no direction around faith or religion or connectedness to God like that, because the person might be an atheist and not. And so there are times that I carried language that used to carry me, and I didn't set out to write about that publicly. But I kept asking myself the question that I ask everyone else, what's the most honest thing you can say right now? And you know what? This book was it. This was it. Everything I write comes back to the same conviction. The wound is not the end of the story. Whatever you've been through, that wound is not the end of the story. And the drift is not the final word. If you're still here, something in you has not given up, and that matters more than most people realize. You are still here. And what's so significant about that statement is, if you're still here, that still matters. You still get to write how your story ends. Mm-hmm. If you're not here, you don't get to do that. And it doesn't matter the hell you've been through. If you're still here, if you're hearing my voice right now, you're operating at 100% success rate of being here. Now, I don't know what else you operate at 100% at, but that's a really good one. So let's keep doing that. And I know I just used the word drift. Most people who drift from something that they love do not make a decision to leave it. There's no moment they can really point to, like a dramatic break or a conscious choice to drift from it. Because when you drift, you do it unconsciously. And you just got busy. Uh-huh. People get busy. And busy is so acceptable and sometimes even praised. And it's so easily mistaken for faithfulness that nobody around them notices, including them. So because life fills in, responsibilities, they multiply. And the space where something sacred used to live gets quietly occupied by everything that's urgent. And then one day they look up and then they realize the connection they once felt has gone quiet. And they can't say when it happened. That is drift, not rebellion, not failure, not even doubt in a way that most people mean doubt, okay? It's just this slow accumulation of distance that builds in the space between decisions. Nobody announced it and nobody planned it, but here you are. And the most distorting part is that everything still looks intact from the outside. You're still showing up, still saying the right things, still fulfilling the role. But from the inside, something essential has gone quiet. And they've been carrying that silence alone, sometimes for years, wondering if something is fundamentally wrong with them. But here's the thing, nothing's wrong with them. They're just far from the source, and far is not the same as finished. You're still here, right? So the question worth asking is not how did I get here? It's whether the way back is possible. And I'm here today to tell you this today because I believe it is. This is everything that I just shared is my understanding of how I had drifted. And not through striving harder or starting over is how you get there. It's through something far simpler and far more honest than either of those. It's through return. It's just a decision.
Why do you think spiritual drift is so difficult to recognize while it's happening?
Yeah, I think most people who drift from something that they love to do, they don't leave it on purpose. Again, they just get busy. So it just becomes acceptable. Drift isn't a decision. It's what happens in the space between decisions. So I don't think you wake up one morning and you choose distance, like, I'm gonna drift, because I think you just stop choosing nearness. And for a while, the momentum of what you built will carry you forward. Just like, you know, if somebody pushes you out into the water, there's a period of time that no matter the waves or the current that are there, you'll go forward. But eventually, unless you're intentionally continuing to move forward, that current, that the wind, the forces against the boat that you're in will start to push against it in a different direction. And it's not that you intentionally wanted to go that direction. It's just the current of life, right? The words still come, the practices continue, the roles stay intact, but underneath, something shifted. And the thing that used to give you life has become something you manage. And managing is not the same as living. So the dangerous part about drift is that it feels like a season. And you even tell yourself, everyone goes through these seasons. Everyone goes through these dry patches, right? But sometimes what felt like a season becomes a residence. And then you realize one day that you've been living there for years and you were performing a version of yourself that used to be real, but now is familiar. And you look around and you're like, how did I get here? I know that there's people watching this that are thinking, man, I've been there where I just was there and everything was good. And on the outside, everything looked like success. But inside, you felt hollow or empty. And you were just thinking like, how did I get to this spot? Well, that's drift. You don't drift consciously. You always drift unconsciously. And I can't think the best thing in the world to have is a good, trusted friend around that is like, hey, how are you? What's really going on? What's happening in here? And, you know, one of the reasons that I love writing about the outdoor so much is because it's not everybody has that trusted person to be like, hey, how's life really, right?
It's true.
I call them 2 a.m. friends, 3 a.m. friends. It's all really good to have one of those. That's the person where, like, if you're on the side of the road at 3 a.m. and you blew a tire, you can call them up and they're like, hey, I'll be there.
Yeah.
The thing about outdoors and the wild is nature always shows up as long as you do. And nature forces you to slow down. It forces you to recognize your environment, what's happening around you. Sometimes life is moving so fast and when I say the performance of life, don't hear condemnation and don't hear that performance is a bad thing. Performance is only a bad thing if it causes you to not recognize where you're standing. That's the only problem. And so when you get busy and you get too busy to know where you are locationally in your heart, that's when performance becomes almost like an avoidance tool, almost like a distraction. You know, a lot of people, and I know that you've spoken to many people who have suffered trauma, in a lot of the ways that a lot of people deal with hurts and pains is just get busy, right? Mm-hmm. Just get busy, you know, fill your life with a bunch of things, go on trips, you know, get a career, be successful on the outside. And then one day everything slows down. And now just by proximity, there's no noise and you're left with, who am I now? Why am I here? And what's the next step forward? And those are actually great questions to ask yourself, but only if you're intentionally asking yourself those questions. If they happen upon you without you being intentional about it, that could be a very existential reckoning. I guess is a good way to say it.
Yeah, or like confusing. It's like being in a void and not knowing, standing in a darkness, not knowing where to turn and what to do. Dr. Carter, I want to talk about the cover of your book. And there's a word. I've never heard it before. It's Japanese art. Is it kintsugi? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So kintsugi. Your cover features kintsugi, the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery with gold. So tell us why that image was so foundational and important for this book.
Yeah, the philosophy underneath kintsugi, it's simple and revolutionary at the same time. You do not hide the break. You honor it. You fill the fracture with something precious, and the repaired piece becomes more beautiful and more valuable than it was before it broke. In Japan, what they do is they take broken pottery and they fuse the cracks with pure gold, making the broken pottery more valuable than the pottery that has no cracks, that has no visible scars. I chose that image because it's the most honest visual I know for what this book is trying to say. Most people who've drifted from a living faith spend enormous energy hiding the fracture. They perform wholeness that they don't feel, and the cover says something different. It says the break is visible and that the break is where the gold goes. See, the gospel was never meant to be a performance of unbroken things. It was always meant to move through cracked ones. And so kintsugi on the cover, it's a quiet announcement before the reader opens a single page that this book is not going to ask you to pretend. It's going to ask you to let the gold into the fracture.
That's interesting. I love that. Why do you think so? Or what do you think people get wrong about brokenness most of the time?
Yeah, I think when people experience brokenness, I think that brokenness becomes their identity, right? You know, mm-hmm. You hear this a lot about a victim mentality. And listen, I'm not saying people aren't victims. And I'm not saying that you can't have a victim mentality. If you live there too long, then you'll begin to take on that identity and you'll always be the victim. Mm-hmm. There's a word that we use around clinical spaces, Lisa, and the word is trigger. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is language is so important, and a deconstruction of language is even more important. And what I mean by that is it's far more important for me to understand what other people mean when they say a word than it is for me to try and make them understand my interpretation, right? Because if I'm genuinely connecting with people to walk with them where they need to go, then I need to understand what they mean when they say a specific word, okay? What does compassion mean to them? What does forgiveness mean to them? What does drift mean to them? And there's this word that we use called trigger, right? What's your trigger? And the problem with that word is around clinical spaces, most clinicians have used that word to identify something negative. If I lined up 1,000 people outside the clinic and I was like, hey, what's your trigger? Most of them, if not all of them, are going to describe something negative. Mm-hmm. But let's be real about something. Not all triggers are negative. Some triggers are very positive. And so when we hear the word brokenness, immediately most people think of something negative, like broken means bad. Broken means not usable. Broken means to be discarded. And that's the very importance of what kintsugi is. You don't discard what's broken. You use what's broken to rebuild something better. Here's the really cool thing. You know, if a bone breaks, it's almost impossible for that bone to re-break where it has mended.
Interesting.
So when you think of the model of kintsugi, those places where the bowl has been reinforced with gold, it's impossible for those areas to re-break because they're reinforced. Now, there might be other breaks in the pottery, but not where it's been reinforced. And so brokenness doesn't mean the end. Brokenness doesn't mean the end of your story. Brokenness just means this is a season that I've got to see how can I fill this situation with something that is going to make it or make me stronger. I'm not giving up, right? When people have gone through things and they've gotten to the other side, you know, just look, Lisa, think about your own life. Think of areas, think of the times in your life when you thought that day was your worst day, that whatever was happening that day, it was going to break you, and then this was going to be your worst day. And I would almost go out on a limb and say, the day you thought was going to be your worst day just might have ended up being one of your best days, because on this side of it, you've realized it's something I went through, maybe something I had to go through. And on this side of it, I'm stronger than I ever was before, and it didn't break me.
Absolutely. And I feel like people, like most people, try and hide those fractures and the things that happen to them. I love how the kintsugi is like, it's showing them, it's gold. It's like, that's the part that makes you so unique. And it's not about being broken. It's about piecing yourself back together in a stronger version of you. Oh, it's such an interesting concept.
Yeah, I use kintsugi in just about everything I do clinically because it's such a great living metaphor of what it looks like to overcome brokenness, to overcome identity fractures, and to, you know, I say this often, I say healing isn't forgetting, it's remembering differently. You know, trying to forget is worse than remembering, because not only do you deal with the anxiety that you still remember, you also deal with the anxiety that you're trying to forget. Right. And many times we don't need to focus so much on forgetting. We need to focus on, how do I move forward? This isn't going anywhere. You know, that loss connected to your trauma, that hurt, that it's not going anywhere. If there was a pill that people could take to forget everything, then listen, that would be the most probably bought pill in the history of our existence, but it doesn't 100%. Exist. I have a mentor that is dear to me, Dr. Keith Metter, and he says one of the greatest moves a person can make in their life is to take unbearable pain and turn it into livable disappointment. And I know livable disappointment doesn't sound like much of a prize unless it's weighed against unbearable pain. And that's the thing about traumatic grief and loss. Getting to the place where you can live with the pain is probably because you've entered into the place of purpose. And because you have purpose in your life, you will live and maybe live with some disappointment, but that's okay, because you'll never forget that loss. Look, nobody ever forgets the loss of a child. Nobody ever forgets sometimes the loss of a loved one, someone that's close to you. That the reason that you hurt is because of the amount of love that you carried. And a lot of times when people suffer, you know, we've talked a lot about moral injury in the past, and moral injury is just it's a violation of what's right to you. It's something that's super important to you. And what happens is, when you experience that, the very evidence of the pain proves that you have moral integrity. Because if you didn't have pain over that situation, it wouldn't matter to you. You wouldn't have a moral injury if you didn't have morals. But shame tries to tell you, like, you experienced that, you're a terrible person, right? I know we had talked about this earlier. A lot of times people ask me, what's the difference between post-traumatic stress and moral injury? And I say post-traumatic stress tries to tell you you're not safe. Moral injury tries to tell you you're no good. You're good. The simple fact that you're hurting morally is proof. It's evidence that you're good. Don't let shame try to tell you you're not. Because if you didn't have morals, then that's when it wouldn't matter to you. But the simple fact that it matters is proof of your goodness, not proof of your badness.
So, Dr. Carter, I want to ask you about solutions. And we talked about drifting. I want to talk about the way back. So what does the first step back actually look like in real life?
Yeah. So slower than people expect and quieter than they hope. That's what it looks like. Return doesn't feel like revival. It feels like relief. The pressure to perform lifts a little. Prayer becomes honest instead of managed. And then reading scripture becomes a place you sit instead of like a tool you use. I know I said last time we talked, I talked about how a lot of people get into these Bible reading programs and they get so focused on making sure that they read their two chapters, you know, and to make it to the next day, that it's so performance driven, they quit encountering scripture to have scripture encounter them. And it's not that they do that intentionally, you know, in them, they're like, hey, I want to read the Bible in a year. That's great. But what if you read the whole Bible in a year and it never changes you because you never sat with something long enough for it to change you. And so the first movement is the simplest, but it's the hardest. You stop trying to produce something for God and you start being present to. Mm-hmm. And for people who have built their identity around production, that distinction right there is enormous. Stop trying to produce something for God and just start being present with God. There's a story that I use in this book that I think is the best story that really explains what I'm talking about. Everybody who is familiar with the Christian faith, they know the story of David and Goliath. You know, they know the story of Jonah and the whale. I mean, they've all heard this in stories. And so everybody knows the story of the prodigal son. It's the son that was in the house with the father and he's like, Dad, I want my inheritance. And then his dad gives him everything that was his inheritance. And he runs off and he just lives in any way that he wants, spends everything that the father gave him. And he finds himself in a pig pen, no money, starving. And he's eating on the husks of the corn cobs and whatever with the pigs. Okay. And he's because he's so hungry and he's thinking to himself, man, I would just love to be back in the father's house, even if I was just a servant. That would be better than being in the pig pen where I am now. And so he starts the journey back to the father's house. And when he gets to the father's house, the father has been outside looking for his return. And he approaches the father's house with this great shame, like this, you know, I'm a failure. I've did it all wrong. I've walked away from you and I just wasn't who I should have been or who I wanted to be. Please just take me as I am and just let me just be a servant, you know, let me just be a nobody, but just being close to the father's house is better than where I was. And the father gives him his robe and restores him to sonship, right? He restores him to exactly where he was before he left. And listen, great story, amazing story, okay? But that's not the most important person in that story. The most important person in that story is the eldest brother who never got his inheritance, who never left the house. He always did all the right things. He, you know, got up and took care of the sheep and goats and fed them at the right time and performative. He made all the right moves, except he didn't know where he was or who he was. Or even more importantly, he didn't have the heart of his father that he was, in all intents and purposes, in the same house. The problem was he never took a minute a day just to sit down with his dad with a cup of coffee just to have relationship. So he lived in the father's house, but didn't know as a son what was his. He didn't know as a son what his father's heart was. And as a matter of fact, when his younger brother came back after doing all this stuff, he didn't even recognize him as a brother. He said, that son of yours, I can't believe he did that. Like he just went and did all that and you're going to celebrate him because of this? I think the real tragedy, Lisa, is to live in the father's house and never have a relationship with the father. Mm-hmm. To be around God and never know who you are with God. That's a lot of the heart behind this book, is exposing the lack of relationship that the oldest son, the elder brother, didn't have with the father, and that could have been different. You know, like I've heard people say, you can stand in the garage all day long, but it doesn't make you a car. And again, I don't want anybody hearing this to think, oh my gosh, I'm going to read this book and I'm going to feel condemned. And what if I'm the eldest brother? And, you know, no, that's not what this is about. This is genuinely about recognition. One thing's for certain, if you can't recognize where you are, then you don't know where you're standing. If you use a GPS, everybody uses GPS right now, whether you use Waze or Google Maps or anything. There's three coordinates that you have to go to someplace. You have to know where you want to go. You have to have an address. And you have to know where you are. You've got to start. And then guess what? Those two things link up with a satellite and they give you the direction to where you need to go. That's why it's called a global positioning system. Well, let's change that a little bit. Let's say GPS is a God positioning system. Okay. Well, if you want to know where you want to go with God, you first have to kind of have an understanding of hope of, well, what do you want to fulfill in your life? What is it that you want to do? And then you have to have an honest recognition of like where you are. Once you can intentionally be present with where you are, then there's probably a better understanding of that you're going to find out where you need to go. That's all this book is about. It's about locating yourself. It's about locating yourself so that maybe you can take a hopeful and an intentional step forward to where you really feel like you want to go. And I believe that most people who want relationship with God want relationship with God in an authentic way. So exposing the drift, exposing the busyness is not condemnation. It's a recognition. It's just information. And I hope that anybody who gets information will take the information that they get and take the faithful steps forward to be exactly where they feel like they want to go.
I'm super excited. And again, your book was launched today. I would love for you to tell the audience what you hope that they feel when they close the last final page of this book. What do you hope they're feeling?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will tell you, out of the 40 books that I've written, this answer is universal: less alone. I hope they feel less alone. In this one specifically, less alone in the drift and more convinced that the back door is open. I don't want them to feel motivated because motivation fades. What I really want them to feel, Lisa, is I want them to feel seen. Seen. When a person feels genuinely seen in the thing that they've been most afraid to name, something shifts for them. Not everything, but maybe just the posture. And from a different posture, everything becomes possible. That's what I hope. I hope they feel less alone.
I love that. Everybody should feel a part of something, and the reconnection that this book is going to give people will give them that hope. That's powerful. What is the message that you hope would stay with them, say, 6 months after reading your book?
Yeah, confession, not condemnation. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I'm not pointing at anyone in this book. I'm describing myself. The seasons I write about are seasons that I lived, and the drift I name is the drift I know from the inside. Condemnation says you're wrong and you should feel ashamed. Confession says I know this territory because I've seen it, and I want to show you the way back. One closes the door and the other opens it. So I hope that after they read this, they realize that Carter, all he did was open a door. I just want to open a door. And if opening and exposing my own life in a very vulnerable way helps one single person find the door that they need to walk through, that's it. I've accomplished my goal.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, for celebrating launch day with us, and for talking to us more about this book. It's such an important message. And do you have any last minute thoughts you want to share today, or any other comments?
You know what? I just want to say, look, if you feel like something you've heard in this resonates with you, please go to Plagiarizing the Gospel and check it out. It's plagiarizingthegospel.com. You can also find out all things about me at drcartercheck.com. Would love to connect with you and let's do life together. I'm not the smartest person in the room and never, you know, portray to be, but I definitely have experienced some significant losses in my life. And I think that loss is that common connector of all traumatic experiences for everyone. If you've been through something, you've lost something. And I think what the Lord has really gifted me with is the ability to walk with people through significant losses and help walk with them in such a way that they might find a sense of recovery for what they've lost.
I love that. Again, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing your knowledge and your story and for opening that door for people.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you to our audience for tuning in. One of the most powerful things that Dr. Carter said today is that the goal of his is to help people feel seen. And I feel like he's going to give language to you for some of the things you've been carrying. And when you have that language through this book, you're going to be able to piece everything back together and you're going to see changes happening in your life. And so the book again is called Plagiarizing the Gospel, and it is available right now at plagiarizingthegospel.com. We will put the link in the show notes for you to have access to. And again, Carter, thank you for being here and congratulations on launch day on the book and for joining us on the show. And to everybody else, Take care and be good to yourself. Have a great day, everyone. Bye for now.